Welcome to the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast, produced by the History Network. If you have any comments or ideas, email editor@ancient-warfare.com. And for other discussions, check out the Ancient Warfare Forum, which you can find a link to at www.ancient-warfare.com. You can also find all the History Network podcasts by going to www.thehistorynetwork.org.
Hi everyone, it's time for another podcast from Ancient Warfare Magazine, and the issue under discussion today is issue 3-4, entitled Implacable Enemies, the Barkids at War, which we published this August. It's a familiar topic, basically the Second Punic War, but it's an attempt to discuss well-trodden ground from the opposite side, namely Carthaginians. Obviously, this provides an interesting problem, as next to no direct literary sources survive from the Punic side of things, so we're left to discuss the Carthaginians through Roman eyes. In this issue, we started with a historical introduction of the Barkid family, and though we didn't have space for a separate article, Hamilcar Barca, the paterfamilias, so to speak, was an accomplished general in his own right, who expanded Carthaginian power in Spain and laid the basis for his famous son's cavalcade through Italy. The source this issue simply had to be Polybius, and Jona Lendring provided us with an overview of this Greek author's interesting life and focal points for his study. Held hostage by the Romans, he became a family friend of the Scipiones and Aemilii. Both those families featured very large on the Roman side in all Punic Wars, which provided him with excellent sources for his history of the rise of Rome. And at the same time, this cast, of course, lots of doubt on the dependability of his testimony. The meat, so to speak, of this issue came in four articles. One by Paul McDonald Staff and Alberto Perez about the Barkid armies, which showed how the Carthaginian generals, despite the great variety in troop types and origins, managed to weld them into a flexible professional fighting force. This article was followed by a discussion of Carthaginian siegecraft. Hannibal is often accused of lacking these qualities after the Battle of Cannae, when everybody supposes he would have besieged Rome. But Duncan Campbell showed that this actually wasn't the case. Hannibal certainly had the capability and technology to besiege Rome, but the logistics of his campaign simply did not allow for it. Obviously, the Battle of Cannae could not go amiss in this issue, and Rafael D'Amato paints a dramatic picture of this well-known battle. Although it has to be said, he had to use some very questionable sources. He also proposed a different possible location for the battle than is normally accepted. Again, Paul McDonald Staff, last but certainly not least, narrated the story of the second Punic invasion across the Alps. Hannibal's brother Hasdrubal took another Carthaginian army to Italy in 207 BC in an attempt to spring Hannibal from southern Italy, where he had been bottled up by the Romans. Since Cannae, basically. Unlike in the early years of the war, Rome responded very quickly and very efficiently, bringing the invasion to a swift end at the Battle of the Metaurus River. Obviously, there are lots of points to discuss about the Barkid family that we did not have space to discuss in this issue. A couple of things we could discuss: Hannibal Barca himself, contrast between the way of fighting of the Roman and Punic armies. And of course, we ought to kick off by discussing the literary bias. Is it even possible to get a good idea of the Carthaginian armies and their generals from the enemy's writings alone? To help me go over these topics, I'm joined today by our three regulars, Lindsay Powell, Murray Dahm, and Michael Taylor. Let's start by discussing this famous and problematic literary bias. Almost everybody knows Livy is often condemned as being basically a Roman propagandist, and therefore any excuse he makes up for Roman losses against Carthage are automatically suspect. Is it true? Is it valid? And what about the other authors?
I mean, obviously Livy has biases. He's a very patriotic Roman. He's using a long tradition of annalistic Roman sources that generally are going to paint the Romans in a pretty favorable light and do everything they can to tarnish Rome's enemies as being dishonorable or otherwise disreputable. On one hand, I would say it's a bias that's pretty easy to cut through. I mean, if you're just a little critical, you can probably dismiss a lot of the bias and still have a lot of very valuable information left over of Livy. So I'm not sure that I'm terribly bothered by that. Obviously, you know, Livy is someone who has to be read very critically. I think a lot more complex is Polybius. Now, Polybius clearly is emulating the great historian Thucydides. He clearly wants to be as unbiased as possible. He clearly is very, very critical of just about any other historian who tried to write in the third century. This seems because Polybius wanted to establish himself as the historian of the Western Mediterranean says everyone else, you know, just doesn't know what they're talking about and everyone else spreads gossip and I'm the only true unbiased source, which of course we shouldn't believe. Certainly Hannibal was very admiring of Rome, and clearly he also used a lot of Roman sources, particularly for the Second Punic War, the history of Fabius Pictor. But we also know that he's unique in that it seems that he had access to and at times used Carthaginian sources. Particularly there was a Greek named Sosulus, who followed in Hannibal's entourage and witnessed many of the battles that we're talking about, and wrote a seven book history of the war. Polybius manages to disparage Sosulus. He says he's just a guy who his history is nothing more than the gossip you'd find around a barber's chair. But it seems that he used him heavily as a source for Carthaginian military affairs. And we actually do have a fragment which is considered pretty reputable. It doesn't seem to be that he was that bad of a historian. So Polybius is interesting. He clearly is living in Rome. He's talking to these Scipiones. He's talking to these Aemilii. He's got access to the records of those families who clearly have their own side of the story to tell. But he's, unlike Livy, may have some primary sources that are pro-Carthaginian. And that may at times reflect in his narrative of Hannibal's side of the war.
I guess my contribution to that would be just looking at from the point of view of where Polybius and Livy stand historically. So Polybius is virtually a contemporary almost of the Second Punic War. He's writing, what, 203 to 120, so he's actually the Third Punic War. But Livy is actually writing in the sort of 10s, 20s BC, so he's separated by 100-something years. So, I mean, there's going to be naturally some bias and creep, and of course by now Rome is an empire, Augustus is what, Actium, et cetera, et cetera. So his mission, I guess, with writing his story is different than Polybius, because Polybius is, from what I gather, is writing a sort of Roman story for a Greek audience, if that's the way I interpret the paper that was in the magazine.
Yeah. He says at the beginning that he's writing to explain to a Greek audience how Rome, basically from the period of the First Punic War, so what, 364 down to, is that right? No, 264 down to 200, basically in a 50-year period, how Carthage came to be so massively defeated and Rome basically becomes the power in the Mediterranean. It's that.
So it's a kind of a moral story, a political scientist sort of approach.
Yeah. A Greek explanation of Roman greatness.
Yeah,
so it gives rise to the second sophistic that, you know, throughout the Roman Empire in the first two centuries, you have Greeks celebrating their Greekness within the Roman Empire, you know, all the way down to Arian, you know, calling himself Xenophon and all that sort of stuff. We lost the war, is the Greek sort of mentality, but we did all the good stuff. You know, we invented democracy, we invented rhetoric, we invented drama, we invented poetry, we invented history. So you can have beaten us, but we're still great. And so in many ways, it's Polybius from within that same context, having lost the Battle of Pydna in 168, basically saying, well, yeah, we lost, but this is why. It's kind of didactic in that sense to a Greek audience why the Romans won. But then there's the problem, of course, that he's sponsored by a Roman family and he's essentially a hostage, although a very leniently held one. And then there's the modern weight of opinion, of course, is that he's a much more reliable historian than Livy. But you've also got the same problem with Sosulus. Why is a Greek historian writing a history of the Carthaginian wars from the Carthaginian perspective if he's not writing it in Punic? A Greek historian writing a history of the Carthaginian wars in Greek is probably also writing it for Greek readers. It's not for the Punics themselves. It's not for the Carthaginians.
I just wondered, this is the problem, which is right in the introduction of the magazine, that we don't have the Punic, the Phoenician, the Carthaginian sources. So we go back to, well, whoever was writing is what we have, and that's what we've got to deal with. And as Michael said, you know, we can tease through some of the biases that we have, but at least it's an information database of some kind to be able to string a chronology together and try and interpret motives, modes of fighting, battles, and so on.
And there are plenty. There are several more minor authors, of course, who've left treatises or bits of, like, there's stuff in Appian and Raffaello D'Amato used Cilius Italicus, who is probably not entirely dependable, to use an understatement.
Well, they come back at some point. They're probably sharing a common set of historians that they're all reinterpreting. It seems to be the way that Handel kept on, you know, doing the same operas and things by recycling the music from the previous bestseller. It seems to be that's what they would be doing as well. They'd go along to the tabularium, they'd look at the military reports and so on, and then, you know, I'll save myself the trouble. I'll read what was that guy from 100 years ago? I'll pull his down and I'll refresh the text.
Yeah, and certainly one of the things about Livy is Polybius is a major, major source for the period of the Punic Wars and the Macedonian Wars. So, ironically, when we want to know what the lost books of Polybius probably say, oftentimes we go to Livy and just guess. Well, you know, this is on a topic of Polybius would be interested in, and this kind of is the kind of things Polybius would have said. So, this is, you know, Livy's basically translating Polybius into Latin and maybe adding a little of his own commentary, because Polybius himself becomes a major, major source for Livy, who is not using the sources that Polybius used. Probably doesn't use that much Fabius Pictor and isn't familiar with a lot of the other people that Polybius cites.
And I guess the other thing is also he is going to be contemporaneous enough with the events he's describing that he's actually going to see arms and equipment, and he's going to see, you know, the witnesses, people who were there. So there's a kind of like a Herodotus scenario here where he can actually go and talk to participants, where, of course, by the time you get to Livy, they're long dead.
Yeah, I mean, we know, for example, that Polybius interviews Scipio's friend and, you know, basically adjutant, Laelius, who was then over 90. So in that case, Polybius was actually getting eyewitness reports of things like the Battle of Zama or the campaigns of Scipio. And he probably had access to some of the historical records that the Scipionic family maintained, whether it was correspondence or documents or anything like, you know, family histories, which themselves were probably quite biased. So Polybius definitely had access to a lot of good stuff, which is why he's such an important historian that by Livy would have long been lost.
But the other thing by Livy, which probably isn't around at the time of Polybius, is this sort of font of all evil. Well, it's weird because he's one, you've got, you know, Hannibal's at the gates, told to young children, Hannibal will get you, that kind of, he is the boogeyman of Rome, which he gets and keeps for a very long period of time, Hannibal, this image. But he gets a sort of a myth around him. And it's funny because when you start to look at subsequent Roman generalship, they are all emulating Hannibal's behaviors. Walked with his head bare, walked with his men, slept on the ground, ate what they ate, did what they did, which you get throughout Roman history, all the way through to Ammianus, Marcellinus in the 4th century. Pretty much it all starts with Hannibal. Mm-hmm. And so what Hannibal did as an ideal general is very, very Roman in this weird way, that's what a good general should do. And therefore, Livy, for instance, credits Scipio with the same sorts of things. And the description becomes very commonplace. It becomes what they call a topos. But basically, it starts with Hannibal and essentially his conduct on the march through the Alps, you know, that he shares the hardships of his men. And the fact of the matter is that today your great generals share the hardships. We still use that image.
And certainly Hannibal's been emulated tactically, you know, up to the present day in terms of the dream of recreating Cannae of a perfect encirclement has inspired many generals.
Norman Schwarzkopf announcing it.
Yeah, Norman Schwarzkopf obviously said that when he sent the 18th Airborne Corps all the way around in around Saudi Arabia to hit the Iraqis in the Gulf War, he said, "I was thinking about Cannae." Obviously, von Schlieffen, when he was planning the German war plan that would become the invasion of France in World War I, you know, he read Livy to his daughters to put them to sleep because he was obsessed with the Battle of Cannae. It was very strange. Yes. And of course, even in the American Revolutionary War, Daniel Morgan at the Battle of Cowpens
intentionally tried to create an encirclement of British forces by having his, you know, untrained militia retreat, pulling the British in and then encircling them. And he, I think, had a degree, bit of classical education, was trying to recreate Ghana. And those are just three things off the top of my head. But certainly the desire to create an encirclement and is something that's inspired generals to emulate ever since. And of course, the probably best example is none other than Scipio Africanus, who ultimately beats Hannibal by realizing that, gee, if I can do these bold flanking maneuvers, I can cut off, you know, can put myself in a pretty good position, and beats Hannibal in his own game of maneuver, which doesn't seem Roman armies had done much of before.
Yeah, I think.
Well, the fascinating thing that I see here is the issue of Hannibal is actually a very experienced man by the time he gets to fight the Romans on Italian soil, and you get the impression that the Roman generals are actually still novices, but they're very fast learners. And I think the essence of the Roman success was you could keep beating them, but they was kind of taking notes in a checklist. Oh, that works. That didn't work. Oh, yeah, that was. So we'll keep deploying them, and they're a learning organization. So by the time they get to the end of the Second and the Third Punic Wars, that they've probably actually documented a lot of this. And when I was reading somewhere that even though a legate, for example, from a legion, even in the first and second century AD, might only be serving about a 2 or 3 year term in that position, he probably was able to read quite an extensive literature and teach himself a lot about tactical and strategic maneuvers in battles. And no doubt they did look back to Hannibal and what he had done as being the supreme example of that.
Mind you, I think it's the younger generation who learn, because the battles at Ticinus, Trebia, and even Cannae, you've got old-fashioned generals who refuse to learn. So in many ways, Hannibal's biggest mistake was killing the old generation of Roman generals, whereas he allowed people like Scipio Africanus to come up, and Fabius Maximus as well.
And I actually always thought the parallels between Scipio Africanus and Hannibal are interesting, in the sense that we both think of them as these great generals, but both are appointed to commands at a very early age, and both relatively untested. I mean, Hannibal served a bit in Spain before he succeeds Hasdrubal, and Scipio Africanus has served as a military tribune and has, you know, served as his father's aide-de-camp, but never really big commands. And they both basically get their job because of who their father was. Hannibal gets his job because he's Hamilcar Barca's son, and Scipio, who's not then called Africanus, gets his job because he's the son of the consul of 218. So you've got these young, kind of aristocratic men. They both succeed in their father's shoes, and by a strange quirk, instead of being, you know, idiotic fops, which they probably should have been, they are just happen to be the two most brilliant generals of the ancient world.
But I think it's that thing that Rome also is incredibly lucky, in the sense that when it needs great men show up. You know, and what I can't remember the exact quote, you know, that great times demand great men or something. Some Churchillian quote.
Yeah.
But Rome, on the brink of utter defeat, finds the people it needs at the time, first with Fabius Maximus and then Scipio Africanus. And I think their biggest asset is that ability to learn, which they showed in the First Punic War as well, but also that flexibility that the Roman legion had built into it at Cannae, where the idea of moving forward means you're winning. And he basically exploits that to say, well, you're not. You're falling into my trap. And the Roman legion was designed to overcome that with its triple line. But when used in a dogmatic and unthinking way, it really becomes a liability. And it took a Scipio to essentially reintroduce that flexibility to it, I think, when he, you know, moves cohorts aside so that the elephants must run a gauntlet and nullify them as a threat.
I think it's kind of interesting. It's usually said that, you know, Scipio imitates Hannibal. Scipio says, oh, Hannibal outflanked all of our armies, now I'm going to outflank these Punic armies. But it seems, you know, Hannibal is learning from the Romans too. We know that by 216, Punic armies are in Italy are basically armed with captured Roman armor, because Hannibal's kills all these Romans, he strips their bodies, and then he distributes the armor to his troops if it's better than what they've already got. So ironically, the Punic army in Italy might have actually looked quite a lot like a Roman army, being armed with Roman armor and Roman weapons. And also, you know, the classic thing of the Roman army is, yeah, these three battle lines, the Tres Aquies. And at Zama, Hannibal has a triple battle line. He's got his infantry divided into three lines, just like the Romans do. It seems that he felt that this was actually going to be a useful way to develop a military reserve. Didn't seem that he had the same organization to cohorts from Hannibal's or anything that was necessarily legionary, but Hannibal's borrowing from the Romans too. You know, the Romans are borrowing these big maneuver elements, and Hannibal's borrowing equipment and borrowing this triple battle line. So it works both ways.
It also comes to it's a nice segue to the differences between the Roman army and the Carthaginian army. The article by Paul McDonald's staff and Alberto Perez emphasized how different in makeup the Carthaginian army units are. They're very different in ethnic origins, in the methods of fighting, in armament, in armor. And the Barkids are able to weld all these units into a coherent, flexible army. And on the other side, the picture that's painted by Polybius is this Roman army that's very methodical and it fights in those three lines, and that's ingrained in everybody's mind. But of course, we can't forget that the Roman army consists only for 25 to 50% of those legions, and then there's the Roman cavalry, but mainly the other half is all the allied legions, which may or may not have been equipped as Roman soldiers, may or may not have fought as Roman soldiers.
Yeah, they were the Latins and the various others. Yeah,
I think it's all the fault of the 19th century, really. This idea of uniforms, and of equipment. I think that the idea we have, of course, of everyone being equipped the same, is shown to be wrong by Hannibal's stripping the dead. That you upgrade on the battlefield if you come across something better, and it's one of those things. You know, we still get stories of people fighting over armor, and fighting over the right to strip the dead, much, much later in warfare, at a time when, you've got your lorica segmentata, you don't need to upgrade. But it's not a natural thing to do, but it's a normal thing on the battlefield. So you're always going to get change. You're always going to have old weapons and new weapons next to each other. And I think it's also something that we need to think about, that warriors are superstitious. If your sword has seen you through, even though it's generations old, you're not going to replace it. If it's seen you through some scrapes, so to speak, you're going to keep it, because it will become lucky. So again, you're going to have old weapons next to new weapons. That's just the way it is.
We've been sort of like guided somewhat by Trajan's Column. I mean, there you've got the artist probably taking liberty, and everybody is equipped the same way, and it's the same with the Marcus Aurelius Column. I guess when you look to older sculptures, you get somewhat more variegation within the equipment. But I was just looking at page 15 with that wonderful Montefortino helmet with that wonderful sword gash in it. I just go, that is real armor actually that's been used, and it's quite fascinating to look at it.
Yeah, and you wonder if you had that, would you then suddenly replace it, or would it become a lucky helmet because you didn't die?
Well, that's assuming.
That's assuming that the person wearing it didn't die where they stood and therefore it got buried. Yes.
Well, that's always an interesting. One of the things for reenactors, interestingly enough, is was there some padding, or was there some little kind of hat or something you wore underneath? And that's one of the unsolved mysteries of ancient warfare. So that could have absorbed the blow. The fact that it actually hasn't shattered, or the blade hasn't gone through the metal, he'd have had a serious bang on his head. But I think he'd have survived with that. Mm.
Depends. The bronze, especially those older bronze helmets, are often fairly thick, and you don't know, of course. Well, yeah. No, but you wouldn't know the sword that gave that dent. If it was a sword, maybe it was a battle axe type thing. You don't know how hard that was. I mean, if it was a Celtic sword, it may have been bent after that.
It's an odd place for a wound. You know, again, that's the thing, is that we envisage Roman pilar and gladius tactics to be the same. None of this over-the-head swinging stuff that's, left to barbarians. But I think, that the...
But there's no reason this dent couldn't have been made by an over-the-head swinging barbarian.
Exactly. And I think that's the other thing, is that, in battle you're going to do what you do. And, again, our image of the disciplined Roman legionary coming on machine-like, like a scene out of a Sergei Eisenstein film, is very inhuman, in the sense that when the battle panics on you, you're going to do what you do. And, we have several stories of Roman legionaries getting out of line, which is always regarded as a bad thing. But you, when the sheer blind panic takes, you're going to, you know, do what you do. And if you live, you're lucky. If you don't, you're not.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering that the point that was made earlier about the fact that the Carthaginian forces were this amalgam of all these different Ligurians and Gauls and Spaniards and all sorts of wonderful exotic people. If you think, if you combine that with what the Romans were dealing with, I mean, of course, you've got the Rorari, Triari, Principis, Hastati. They're not all fighting with the same weapons either. And then you add to them, of course, their own Socci, their own allies. And of course, it's going to be a very, very mixed blend of people. And amidst the noise and the soil and the dust being kicked up, you know, we come back to this question of how do you command such widely different forces on a battlefield when really you've got to leave it to the individual, presumably section commanders, the squad leaders, the centurions, if it's on the Roman side, to execute the plan, if at that time it's understood.
Mm. Well, in that unwritten manual of Hannibal for business managers, essentially what Hannibal does is he gives each group of different fighting styles a task. You know, they are even though they're completely different styles,
and that makes eminent sense. Back. Yeah, that makes eminent sense,
and it's beautiful management. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not micromanaging them. He's not distrusting them. He's saying, this is your job. I want you to get it done, and how you get it done is fine, given your different style of fighting to these guys. But you know, that's what I want you to do, and I think. You know, that kind of, you know, delegation and ownership of task, horrible, is essentially what Hannibal is brilliant at.
And of course, he's got his brothers and various other trusted subordinates too. The timing in such cases would be very important, of course. You tell somebody what to do, but somebody has to tell him when to do it.
Well, I think, again, that's that. Management strategy, horrible, that they're all literally, and this is the last one, on the same page. And they know what they're doing.
Although clearly at some point that does break down. I think I'm thinking mostly of Zama, where the first line of basically foreign mercenaries has been repulsed and is trying to retreat through the second line, and the second line won't let them through. And there's even reports, and I'm not sure how much I believe them, of the two lines starting to fight each other because the retreating guys want to get away from the Romans. And so clearly this is an example where that coordination between the first line is foreigners, the second line is Carthaginians, and coordination has broke down completely.
Yeah. I think, you know, you could probably trace it that way around, though, couldn't you, if you wanted to?
But by then, of course, it's no longer the experienced army from Spain. I mean, the core it is, and some of his Hannibal's trusted subordinate are gone, have died and captured.
No, that's a very good point. Zama is probably the exception when talking about Hannibal.
Although Hannibal's reputation remains intact after Zama, you know, he goes off and is offering his services, even as an old man, to fight Romans in Asia Minor, and the threat is such that he could do it again, kind of thing. So, you know, it's amazing that his reputation as a general isn't soiled by Zama, and his reputation as a threat is essentially enhanced.
Well, I think the thing is, he was never captured, was he? I mean, he was, what, 19 years or 16 years in Italy, and he was dodging and moving about, but they never caught him. And that, I guess, made him a lucky man to some degree, and that would give him good capital.
Undefeated on Roman soil.
He may not have been the victor, but he also wasn't captured and disgraced in that way. So, he had a good reputation to build on. And reputation in the ancient world is a very, very valuable thing.
Yes, the morale factor in battle should certainly be a topic of another discussion sometime. Probably another issue.
Yes. And I was just thinking, for example, we were going back to the makeup of the armies there. It just occurred to me that with so many different language groups, how you would communicate. I mean, you've got different linguistic needs and skills. I mean, I know the Roman army actually, when it was doing diplomatic things, would be using interpreters. And in fact, as their empire grew, of course, they needed more of them. It's intriguing to know how you would actually make such a diverse operation as that work. Because you're always having to go through intermediaries to explain what you're trying to do. That's my point.
You know, and ironically, you know, American and NATO forces are facing many of the same problems as they try to
work together. And you've got, you know, Americans and Dutch and Germans and Turks, and then they're trying to train the Afghan army at the same time. And I think probably part of it may be simply lingua franca. You know, I think we can say pretty safely that in the Roman army, which includes people who speak Oscan, multiple dialects of Oscan, Faliscan, Latin, possibly some Sabine Gaelic dialects, possibly Greek, some Greeks in the south. So probably they just, you know, spoke Latin, and you were just kind of expected to pick it up as a, you know, part of your military service. And probably they did. I mean, I actually can't think of any evidence for this, but I think we have to assume that Punic became sort of the lingua franca of Hannibal's army, but probably they were also heavily dependent on a lot of, you know, bilingual people who could translate if need be.
I assume that with the right gestures, the expression "they don't like it up 'em" will translate into anything.
Yeah. What did the British do in India? Yeah. They basically made the local troops learn enough English to obey commands, really.
I think that basically is it. Where the British Army was different, for example, is in respect to the modern Gurkha regiments, where I understand that a native British officer is put in charge, but he's expected to learn Gurkha. And I was also reading about the Celts and the Romans, and that there is a suggestion that during the sort of first century BC, which I know is later than the period we're talking about, was that you've got people in charge of their own units working as the precursors of the auxiliary cohorts, if you will, who are basically the captains, chieftains, and so on of their own tribes, and of course they're speaking in their own language. So you've basically got this delegated army. So it comes back to: do we all understand what the plan is? Okay, and then we go back to your original point, Murray, which is: okay, you're a specialist in those kinds of tactics. You do that over there, and those guys, you have to do that over there.
Yeah, and you can almost envisage it being a kudos thing as well. That if you are a tribal chieftain and you are commanding the center, that your reward for doing the job as asked is going to be worth your while, whereas then that kind of army failing in that task is going to presumably lead to some kind of shunning and punishment, or, you know, or a lesser share of the spoils, which is the major problem of mercenary armies, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you get less. Maybe there's bonuses. You know. Target KPIs. Oh gosh, horrible.
No, but I think you're right. I think the pull, the appeal of the spoils, the spolia at the end of the. I mean, that is its own reward for a lot of these people. I mean, they get to survive the battle. They presumably get paid as mercenaries, or I think one of the terms in here was devotio, which is the loyalty and the fealty, if you almost like a medieval concept, that you have sworn yourself to serve your leader. And you will do that to the best of your ability. And that was particularly true of the Celtic warriors. You know?
Although at the same time, we shouldn't necessarily act that the Romans were any more modern in this sense. I mean, the most systematic description of the looting of a city we have is Polybius's descriptions of the Romans looting New Carthage. And Polybius is really impressed at how methodical the Romans are about sacking this place and piling up all the booty. And, you know, the average Roman soldier, again, there's these sort of edifying images that he's this patriotic peasant fighting for, you know, his home and his country and his little hut and his wife. But certainly Roman soldiers were motivated by loot and booty and loyalty to their leaders. And you know, I believe actually Scipio Africanus coming back from Zama is one of the first real good examples we have of a donative being paid to soldiers from all the loot that he's taken in Africa. So we shouldn't perhaps say that this is only a phenomenon for these primitive Celtic tribes. I mean, the Romans are certainly in it for loot and booty, and they may even do it much better than Hannibal's you know, horde does it.
Yeah. I was going to make the point, I'm one of those people who doesn't believe the Celts were actually primitive. But the other thing I was going to make, though, was the point that at this time we're talking pre-Marius, so we're not actually talking a professional Roman army. We're talking of guys who are the plebeians or the farmers or the farmhands who've been basically told, right, we're recruiting. We need 500 volunteers. Off you go. You know, the Wallones. So off they're going. And the expectation is that they're going to, presumably after the campaign is wrapped up, they'll take whatever the loot and spoils they've got, and that's going to be their reward. And they're going to go back to plow the farm. And unfortunately, when they got back, what they had found was, of course, the big landowners were gradually encroaching and taking their land. So they basically had nothing. So the terrible irony of all this is that these people are going out and serving their country, and the country is actually not serving them. So you end up with this. Ultimately, you get the disruption which leads to the Gracchi brothers and all these other terrible internal switch, which Polybius, I guess, was upset to see.
Well, there are several authors who trace Rome's decline from the influx of wealth during the Punic Wars, that it corrupts the Roman because they get greedy, they get wealthy, you know, they get more than they ever used to have because they used to be farmers who ploughed the land, and then they suddenly become empire owners who have different concerns. And I think, it's a problem. And I think, 100 years later, when Marius reforms the structure of the army, I think that's the final step in a long disintegration of what we know in the historians as the way a Roman army was formed. I think the land qualification had been dropping constantly, probably from the time of the Second Punic War, because that's the other problem, is that Rome loses multiple tens of thousands of men and yet can replace them.
Polybius mentions this, I think, for 215, 214, somewhere around just after Cannae, that the requirements are lowered. And of course, not just the requirements are lowered, but they're also messing with the value of the money.
They devalue the ass.
Sometimes we're not well served by our sources.
Well, that also relates to, for example, if you're recruiting these people at reasonably fast notice or short notice, what degree of training are they getting? I mean, a lot of it sounds to me like, for example, they get given like 2 weeks square bashing, and this is how you throw this, and this is how you hold the other, and march in time when you're told to, and watch the guy to your right and your left. Mm. But most of it's actually going to be on the battlefield, it sounds like to me, which is quite a frightening idea.
Oh no, I was just going to say. I mean, the essentially you're right. I mean, it seems that these guys are getting almost nothing, and that may be why Rome, as it starts taking heavy casualties in 218, 217, 216, keeps losing people because it has these incredibly amateur, inexperienced armies that get massacred again and again. One thing that is interesting is in Spain, we actually see Scipio Africanus setting up a training regime for his soldiers, which is one of the very few documented instances of a formulated, regimented training regime in ancient armies, where on day one they do this, on day two they do this, on day three they rest, on day one they cycle starts over again, which probably is he has to do because he has such an inexperienced, amateur militia type force.
There's a great scene in the 1936 film Scipio Africanus, one where he basically shows what he's going to do on a chessboard, which is hilariously anachronistic. But the second one is he basically in battle runs forward and shows his troops how to throw the pila at the elephants, and it's quite hilarious. Just reminded me of that.
I was going to say, from what I remember reading of the article, there were actually very few elephants. There was only like 40, I think, that they ever took, and actually very few made it to Italy. So I wonder whether that's the propaganda element. I mean, it makes great press, but it's not really.
That was for Zama. That was for Zama. I think they do though. Elephants are great fear weapons rather than practical. Because even though there's only one, there's still elephants everywhere in artistic depictions.
Yeah, and the odd thing is, of course, it's not the first time at all that the Romans meet them. They first met them when they fought Pyrrhus over half a century before, and figured out quite effectively how to fight them, I think. But it must have made a very impressive propaganda image.
Well, I'm wondering, the analogy I would use is the First World War trench warfare, where the British suddenly revealed the tank. And I guess the first guy who saw one related back, was terrified. And then after a couple of days, they got a tank.
But the Roman, there was only one elephant that's made it across the Alps at all, and I think that one even died fairly quickly after. That was interesting. One of the things in it's mentioned by Silius Italicus about Cannae is he just suddenly conjures up a whole squadron of elephants. Come, I don't know. It must have sort of stuck in the collective mind that Hannibal came with these outlandish. And I'm sure that's part of the propaganda value. They're not just big and impressive. They're un-Roman.
Oh, certainly. I mean, Hannibal does receive a contingent of elements that are landed by sea. I think in 214 or 215, I can't remember the date. He gets a small naval reinforcement, and he gets some more elephants, but he doesn't really do anything with them.
And interestingly enough, the time when he has the most elephants is at Zam. I think he has 80, which is, I think, the most he's had any time during the war. And we all know how that ends. But certainly, I guess we can envision, yeah, when the Romans have to have a big, you know, circus game and they want to slaughter some beasts and they want to, you know, reenact Hannibal versus Scipio or whatever, that they, you know, herd in a whole bunch of hapless elephants and butcher them for the public amusement. And probably that's how this starts getting itself gelled in the collective consciousness.
But that's how probably a lot of Romans learned their history, you know, where they went to the arena. We have a battle of the, you know, the savages from Bactria and the Scipios against the whoever it was.
It's funny because when you read some of the sources, you know, like the Silius Italicus, you've got these amazingly contradictory images that you're like, surely everyone would have gone, no, that's not right. But we don't get any evidence of that. No one, you know, we don't have any source criticism or contemporary criticism of Silius using elephants, for instance. It's almost like
I guess that's because our interpretation of history is somewhat different than the ancient world. I mean, and it comes back to there's a combination of the rhetorical arts. Some of the older ones were the analysts, as I think has been said earlier. I think Michael said that. But it was a different treatment than ours, which has a premium on objectivity.
Yes, I think they're more flexible.
Well, although at the same time, if you read Livy, for example, like when Livy talks about how many troops Scipio took over to Africa, he does say, you know, well, one source says this, source B says this, source C says this. I have no idea which one is right, so I'm giving you all of them. Mm-hmm. And you do sometimes see Livy being critical of his sources. For example, there's a pompous first century analyst called Valerius Antetus, who apparently, you know, writes all these dramatic battle scenes. And Livy oftentimes will single him out as saying, you know, Flavius says this and Valerius says this. And I think Valerius is just full of hooey.
But the tragedy is we don't have the Punic or the Carthaginian sources to give their side of the story. So, you know, we come back to the basic issue, which you start off with, Jasper, that we have to see it through what we call classicalized, the Greek and the Roman, and we make of them what we will and hope that archaeology can fill the gaps. And of course, the Romans did a great job of leveling Carthage, delenda est Carthago, so we don't have much evidence from that either, I guess.
It's sad but true. Having said that, perhaps that's a good note to end on. Thank you very much, everybody, and talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast, produced by the History Network. If you have any comments or ideas, email editor@ancient-warfare.com. And for other discussions, check out the Ancient Warfare Forum, which you can find a link to at www.ancient-warfare.com. Don't forget, you can also find all the History Network podcasts by going to www.thehistorynetwork.org.